I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel. The Secretary of State put another hold on an initiative petition to raise Oklahoma's minimum wage to $15 by 2029. Apparently, opponents of State Question 832, the State Chamber of Commerce, and Oklahoma Farm Bureau are requesting a rehearing from the state Supreme Court. Ryan, why would the organizations be asking for a rehearing?
It's almost definitely a delay tactic. The Supreme Court rarely grants these rehearings, and if they do grant a rehearing, it's very rare that they change their mind. They may add something of substance to their original order, but we're really not going to be, no one should expect that the Supreme Court's going to change their position from their original order, that this petition was valid, had everything that it needed to have to be able to move forward in the process. This is really a delay tactic by these organizations to try to run out the clock. And we've seen that with the other initiative petitions in the past, that the lack of certainty both in the Constitution and in statute around when initiative petitions would appear on a ballot gives the proponents and the opponents a lack of a roadmap. And so if you're an opponent of an initiative petition, dragging that clock out is a key part of your strategy in ending this. Now, I will say I was a little surprised in the rehearing, some of the media around the rehearing. Ben LePack, who's the executive director of the State Chamber Research Foundation, said that the judge, and I'm quoting here from an article in the Daily Oklahoman, that the six justices making the ruling, quote, failed to perform one of the most basic duties of their job by refusing to elaborate in the majority opinion. I'll just say that it's, you know, kind of strange to tell the judges that they didn't do their job whenever they're asking them for this rehearing. It's not really a way to ingratiate themselves. I've been frustrated with the court myself in the past, but a comment like that in the media probably doesn't land well with the justices.
Neva.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, certainly they were pretty straight on saying that that they were concerned about the ambiguity and that that this was very concerning, not only with the constitutionality of the challenged petition, but on and on. And here's exactly the bottom line, like you say, Ryan. Both sides are fighting, one to get it past this process and be able to get signatures and get it on a ballot, and the opponents obviously want to do anything possible to either get a different decision from the court, or at least be able to drag this out a little while longer. So ultimately, it leaves a big question mark as far as what the timeline really is going to be. And I think early on, the expectation was that this could potentially be on the November ballot. Now, as we know, just given the process and all of the things that come along, not only with the petition gathering, but the process through the Secretary of State's office to make sure those are valid signatures and on, and the governor ultimately being the one that gets to decide the date. I think this is going to be something that probably we'll see may move through this year and into next year. We'll just have to wait and see what the court does. But it certainly was not, I think, a surprise to many on the opponent side that they were going to see the state chamber, the Farm Bureau, and others be very aggressive in trying to keep their effort alive to stop this petition process.
And, you know, the right to call for a rehearing is a right of the opponents of the initiative petition. They're not doing anything that's out of left field here, and they're not doing anything that I believe is just outwardly frivolous. I mean, the questions that they've asked the court to resolve, to clear up some of the ambiguity, those are legitimate questions for them to ask the court. But I do think that the underlying motive here is a motive related to timing and trying to delay the initiative process.
And the court voted 6-3. I mean, so it wasn't so close that people would begin to wonder if this came back before the court, would it move another direction? I think that seems to be more clear cut, as you say. And you're right. I think ultimately this is a process that allows everyone the opportunity to do what they need through the courts to get resolution.
Congressman Tom Cole is looking to run one of the most powerful committees in the U.S. House, the District 4 representative, threw his hat in the ring for consideration to be the chairman of Appropriations and Budget. Late last week, shortly after Texas Republican Kay Granger announced she was leaving the seat. Neva, what are Cole's chances here?
I think they're excellent. I mean, if you just look at it on the upshot, I mean, first of all, let's remember Congressman Cole has been on the Appropriations Committee since 2009. He's overseen some of the largest programs and the budgeting and spending in those programs. He's really, the majority of his career has been on the appropriations side. He is someone who was the senior member on the Defense Subcommittee, one of the most powerful subcommittees, which has, in fact, the largest budget, I believe, of any of the subcommittees that have, and has more than half of the discretionary spending in the budget. And he's someone who understands all of the ins and outs, the other subcommittees on labor and health and human services, places where he has spent a lot of time understanding and digging into the domestic spending. He's someone that self-describes as a budget hawk, and he's someone that the other members of Congress and the Republican caucus know Congressman Cole. They know his track record. They know that he's someone that has had an exemplary record in his committee work, and so this is clearly one of the most powerful chairmen when you talk about House appropriations and budget in Congress. And so it would be an extraordinary compliment to the state to have someone in this position. And I think he's laid it out that he's going to make his case and that he wants to be someone that can engage with people across the board and deal with a lot of these issues that are the tough issues. I mean, we talk about immigration being a tough issue to tackle. When you start talking about the budget and appropriations, you're talking about entitlement programs like Social Security and housing and food programs. Those alone make up 60% of all of the spending in the budget. Mm-hmm. So when people talk about they want a balanced budget, it's a big lift to just get into the weeds of these thousands and thousands of pages of bills on appropriations every year. And I think, as he said himself, he's well poised to be able to take on this leadership role if his colleagues decide that is their wish. And it certainly will be something I think many will watch with interest and see how it develops.
Orion.
Well, the website Roll Call, which covers Congress, calls him a heavy favorite. They're reporting that he's the only person that's put his name out there formally. There's another congressman who is currently considering making a run for the appropriations chair position. And you kind of see this divide playing out among Congress where you have more establishment Republicans. Tom Cole has this long career in Congress. He is part of the more establishment wing of the party. He voted along with many of the subcommittee members of the current appropriations team to pass along a spending bill that kept the government running. He is expected to be somebody that can work across the aisle and has demonstrated the ability to do that in the past, often sometimes at odds with his own party. Right now, Roll Call is reporting that he has the support of 9 subcommittee appropriation chairs already. These individuals are often called the cardinals, similar to the selection of the Pope, and that is having 9 of those subcommittee chairs already endorsing you. Steve Womack, one of the congressmen who's the subcommittee chair, said he is the most capable and the most prepared. He said, quote, "There's not even a close second in my opinion."
And it's interesting because when you say 9 of these subcommittee chairs, I think there's only 12
correct
total. So you're looking at overwhelming support right on the front end of this process of trying to be selected or voted.
And if you look, currently right now, Speaker Johnson, who is potentially facing some challenges from the far right in his caucus already, as everyone expected that he would. And now, especially with the spending bill that he approved and put his seal of approval on, I think that you'll probably see the Speaker's wing of support go with Congressman Cole. And I think that this is, good news for the state of Oklahoma. Whenever you have someone from your state that is chairing one of, if not the most powerful committee in Congress, then that puts your state front and center in these budget conversations. It doesn't mean that Congressman Cole's going to go to that committee and just immediately bring all the slush money back to Oklahoma, but it does mean that the priorities that we're facing as a state become front and center before that committee, and I think that that's good news for all of us.
Another State Department of Education employee might have resigned. According to Oklahoma City's News Channel 4, Jenna Thomas left her role as chief of staff late last week. At least two other top employees have resigned in recent weeks. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this news?
Well, let's start with the way that you described it, Michael. You said might have resigned. And that's because news organizations, the media, haven't been able to confirm whether or not the chief of staff has actually resigned from the State Department of Education. You have a state lawmaker, Chairman Mark McBride, who chairs the Education Committee over in the Oklahoma House of Representatives. He doesn't even seem to know whether or not there is a chief of staff in that position. And so if there's not a person that is manning the chief of staff role within the State Department of Education, you can look and see there is a clear absence of leadership and work that is being done at almost every critical level in that organization. This is, we talk about failed states. This is a failed department at this point. We are watching the department that has the most amount of funding going to it in the state of Oklahoma. That's one of the most important charges for the people of Oklahoma to have a functional system of public education and instruction. It is in free fall. And I think that we're beginning to see instances where legislative leadership and even the governor have begun to kind of distance themselves from Walters somewhat. And I think we'll talk more about his Superintendent Walters poll numbers later in the show. But this really does, to me, demonstrate just imminent collapse. This isn't people jumping off of a sinking ship. This is people floating up and gasping for air because the ship's already sunk. And we saw reports the other night of people camping out in front of the State Department of Education so that they could be there early in the morning for the hearing so that they would have seats. You had staff members within the State Department of Education going out to doors that were already locked. Nobody was trying to get in, wrapping electrical cord around the doors to try to keep people out, which is probably a fire code violation. I mean, I don't know for sure, but maybe the state fire marshal can answer that one for us. This organization, and I think, you know, Ryan Walters himself, are in free fall whenever it comes to actually doing the job that the people of Oklahoma elected him to do. But I will agree with one thing. There was a story where he said, why are people surprised? He essentially said, why are people surprised that I'm saying all of these things? This is what I said on the campaign trail. And it is. And so I think it's a lesson to all voters. When you hear these candidates out on the campaign trail telling you these things, sometimes they actually mean it. And we've kind of got what we thought we were going to get with Ryan Walters, but it turns out to be even worse.
Neva.
Well, you know what's interesting, and I think why there's such focus on who is at the State Department and in what positions, is the fact that we're now 15 months into Ryan Walters' administration, and what we continue to see, the honeymoon is long over. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we're into the managing of, as you say, the largest state agency in terms of a $1 billion budget, and the fact that if there is no chief of staff, if there is no general counsel, two positions that in any agency, just like in a national administration where you have cabinet members that are with many assigned very high-level duties, in this instance, when you don't have a chief of staff, you basically don't have that person who normally is tasked with running the agency.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an elected official who is the face, who sets the agenda, who sets the tone, who drives the policy, but you have to have someone internally who is making sure that these large number of state employees in the State Department of Education are being able to do their job, being able to function, meet deadlines, and on down the road. So you have no chief of staff, it would appear, by many accounts. You have a general counsel who's left, so who's taking care of addressing the legal side of all of this? Is the department following the laws, following the statute, implementing the things that the legislature has intended for the department to do? And you go on down to not having a director of accreditation, the accreditation being the pivotal place of where all of this in the State Department really turns around accreditation, making sure that the districts can meet the requirements. And then you get into the issues that no one seems to be able to get a handle on, that I, from what I have heard at the Capitol, of just what's going on with the federal grants, what's going on with getting money to the school districts. Many districts now saying they don't have dollars that they were expecting, and it's going to have definite major implications on their budgets. So there's lots of red flags. And as you say, you have these folks in, that are chairing the education committees in the House, in particular in the Senate, and even across the board in state government, that are stepping back and saying, when is this going to slow down? When is this going to get fixed? And why isn't Ryan Walters being more forthcoming, or the people that are speaking for him, and at least giving basic answers to basic questions? Is this person employed or not? If not, we would like to see the resignation letter. We would like to see the timing on it, or any other facts that they're outlining. So it's regrettable that we continue to have, week in and week out, just like we talk about on this show, we have things that could be fixed. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing now is the public, by and large, is growing weary of much of what's gone on. Even if they're just capturing the headlines, they've got more questions probably than answers when it comes to education in the state of Oklahoma.
And I think it probably seemed like a far-fetched idea to talk about it a few months ago, but you said we're 18 months into the term. We're not even halfway through his term at this point. And so the question remains, are we going to wait until 2026, the next election, and see if he runs for re-election to begin with? I mean, he seems to have this fantasy of being governor of the state of Oklahoma still kicking around. But if he does run again for superintendent of public instruction and he wins or loses, whatever that may be, or do we begin to see serious talk about impeachment? And impeachment in our state constitution is very clear with this office, and as with other offices, it says that the individual shall be subject to impeachment, or can be subject to impeachment, for willful neglect of duty. I think that that's a, when we look at the absence of leadership in these key positions. And then the other is incompetency. And I think that Ryan Walters continues to refuse and be obstinate in the face of questions from leadership at all levels about his ability to run this agency competently. I think that if he really wants to begin to make that case, he's got to step out behind this wall. He's got to stop hiding behind his political director. He's got to stop hiding behind his communications director. And he's got to be able to make that case for himself. Because as his poll numbers plummet, as the staff continue to escape the already sunken ship, and as Neva was talking about, we see a failure or potential failure of the actual administration of programs that he is statutorily required to carry out. Can the state stand another 2+ years of this lack of leadership in this critical department?
Favorability ratings are dropping for State Superintendent Ryan Walters amid controversial news. The online news outlet NonDoc is reporting on internal Republican polls showing his favorability in his own party at below 40%, while another finds him far behind other GOP leaders like Governor Stitt. Neva, should Walters be concerned about these numbers?
Well, whether he's concerned about the numbers or not, I think what it reflects is public sentiment. And I think that's the important thing to take note of here. Polling happens, I mean, we're a week away from everyone filing for office late next week. We'll have that take place. And so lawmakers who are going to run for re-election obviously are interested, and many have said publicly that as they go back into their districts, the number one question they get asked about, or the number one individual they get asked about, is Ryan Walters. Mm-hmm. They want to know. And these are people that that care about their local schools, that care about if they have children or grandchildren in those schools. And so you have this kind of setup where there's such an adversarial relationship out there, and he has become such a polarizing figure that it's not a surprise that we're seeing these numbers really start to drop from where they were when he was in his honeymoon in those first months after being elected to a statewide office. But it is important, I think, and I think the voters instinctively, and certainly those who are careful to know about their local school districts, and as I say, have a direct line there, they want to have some assurance that people know what's going on. And it's just like they care about when there's an upheaval in their local school board or with a superintendent or anything else. Now we've got the person over all of education in the state of Oklahoma, and we see that his popularity has dropped below the governor, dropped below many that were polled side by side. And again, polls are a snapshot in time. It doesn't reflect what's going to happen in the next election, but it does say that there's an undercurrent here. And clearly, when your favorability begins to drop and when you have open-ended questions on surveys and people begin to articulate very specifically their concerns or their questions or their dislikes about a particular individual in political office, it has an impact. So I think this is an ongoing story. I think certainly if I were someone with a client that is in public office and they were in a free fall in terms of favorability or at least a lot of negative sentiment out there against them in their community, in their district, in the state, it would be something to take note of and try to deal with.
Ryan.
Well, and polarizing not just among Republicans or Democrats, but among Republicans and among Republican primary voters. And, you know, that's what a lot of these polls that NonDoc reported on were focusing on, were polls that were capturing sentiment of Republican primary voters who tend to be, you know, some of your more conservative voters in the state of Oklahoma. One of those open-ended questions, and you know, when you get these in these polls, it's always interesting to see what people say. But one of those, I just want to point out, was one of the statewide polls that is reported in NonDoc said those responses painted an even more negative perception of Walters, and only, get this, only 0.6% of responses registered as approve or positive. Out of 100%, 0.6% approve or positive. That, I've never seen poll numbers that abysmal for anyone, any question, or any individual or elected official in my entire career in politics. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that is you know, really, you know, trying to find something nice to say about the guy. The only constituency that he had any sort of ground with were individuals that were less likely to have people in public, less likely to have kids in public schools, less likely to have some connection to what's actually happening in their school districts. And I think that, you know, for them, it's easier to see some of the headlines on TV and some of the, you know, sensational stuff that Ryan Walters puts out on social media, and they capture that and they think, oh my gosh, this is happening in these schools. And they don't have a real reality check of, no, these aren't the problems that schools are facing right now. These aren't the things that I could see we could improve my child's education, or as a teacher could improve my ability to do my job, as support staff, my ability to show up and provide critical services for the school district. I think all of this goes back to the fact that Ryan Walters' constituency aren't these individuals in this poll right now. His constituency is a national constituency. I think that even though he would probably like to think that he is potentially somebody who could run for governor in a couple of years, in reality, what he's running for is a job. And I think that the, you know, while if we look at these numbers, 0.6% approval, well, when you get outside of that and you look at the national media, kind of the libs of TikTok world where he is really kind of dwelling in right now, I bet his numbers are a lot higher. You know, people love him, and, you know, he probably embraces that, and that kind of, you know, imbues his spirit. And he's like, well, what are you guys talking about? You know, people really like me. He wakes up in the morning and looks in the mirror and says, you know, libs of TikTok love me. But that's not his electoral constituency. And so to me, what this really demonstrates is we haven't seen a real true response to this. We haven't seen any sort of about face within the department. And that signals to me that he doesn't care.
Well, and one of the things about these surveys, these polls that I thought was interesting, is the fact that it points out that while a number of folks on those open-endeds would say things like they like the fact that he wants to change policy, that education, there are things that need to be fixed. And philosophically, those people that line up with him on many of the issues that he's talked about are comfortable on those issues, but what they're now saying is that they don't like his style. Basically, in one of the summaries, the words that were used, the kind of the takeaway from the pollster was that the upshot was that many considered him too abrasive or too crass or too hard-hitting and direct, talking about the fact that they didn't like the fact that he was so combative and disrespectful to teachers, mm-hmm. to the education community at large. I mean, those things start to permeate down, but there are also things that are correctable if you take into account, here's where we're missing the mark. Here are the things that the public now is saying, our constituents are saying, that they're uncomfortable with, unsure about, or would like to see done a little bit differently. And that's where we'll have to see the test for Ryan Walters. I mean, when people want to score elected officials A to F, I mean, the verdict is out on all of these folks that are in their midterm and have time to go and have time to make changes. But there's a lot of conversation, and certainly these poll numbers for people looking at the primary season right now, June 18th, Republicans going to the polls for a lot of races, will their impression and attitudes about statewide office holders like Ryan Walters and others, will that have implications on some of the down-ballot people that they are asking those questions about and getting answers and trying to decide how all of that scores in their mind in terms of who they want to represent them at every level of government.
And the real dilemma for Ryan Walters here is the things that he would need to do to redeem himself in the eyes of Oklahoma voters are the very things that would put him at odds with the national media audience that he is so evidently courting.
Time is running out for a car tag compact between the Cherokee Nation and the state of Oklahoma. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. is calling on educators and tribal members to contact Governor Stitt to urge him to support the existing deal. Last year, lawmakers approved a temporary extension through December 31st. Ryan, what is the delay here?
Well, the delay seems to be just this continued inability of the governor and, you know, tribal nations to come together on these deals. Now, that being said, the governor's administration and several tribes, including the Cherokees, have reached some compact agreements in the last several months. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is some promise here. There was a car tag renewal compact with, I believe it was the Chickasaw and the Choctaw Nation.
That's right.
That was essentially, you know, the same thing that the Cherokees are looking for, and it was a redo of the status quo, mm-hmm. where you've got this split between, you know, about half the money goes to the tribe and half the money goes to state services for the people of Oklahoma, all Oklahomans. And a lot of that is to public education. You know, public education gets a lot of money out of this. Mm-hmm. And so to delay this any further, I think that, maybe there are some underlying issues here, and this is being used as leverage, and this is really what's out front in terms of the conflict. But maybe behind the scenes that, you know, this may be part of some larger negotiation. I would bet that if the governor and the Cherokee Nation are unable to come to an agreement to either renew a compact for a significant length of time, that we would probably see the legislature maybe even coming in special session in the fall, late fall, and renewing another extension, because this is just too important to let lapse.
Neva.
And that's what they did last year, when they did what they did. But in this instance, there's a little bit of a twist, it appears, because you have the two tribes you mentioned, the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nations. You have state compacts with them that allow for the state to issue the tags, allow for this to be done in a fashion where the information is seamless in terms of with public safety. And I think in the instance of the Cherokees, it appears that there's a disconnect there, that it's not seamless. And I think the governor is pushing back and saying that he wants the arrangement to be a better arrangement. He thinks it would be better for the state. And obviously the tribe differs with that. But hopefully, as you say, Ryan, I mean, there is negotiations going on, and I think that there are even some legislation that's working its way through the session that would allow the Department of Public Safety to share vehicle registration with the Turnpike Authority, because one of the key issues is that the Cherokee tags are not able to be read as they're going along the turnpikes. And so if they can find some resolution or find a way to bridge that problem, they may be well down the road in these negotiations, at least it appears from the outside that that's one of the big sticking points. And you're right, it's a lot of money. I mean, when we talk about payments, I think Principal Chief Hoskin said that in one of the reports that they had just made payments somewhere almost $8 million mm-hmm. to the state of Oklahoma. So, you know, these are significant dollars and something that has to be resolved one way or the other. And you would hope that we're not looking at a special session or some mm-hmm. other drama that kind of extends this way beyond where it is today. And hopefully these negotiators on both sides will be able to get this resolved amicably and in a way that they can move forward for a number of years to come in the compact.
And Chief Hoskin has said that this shouldn't, the toll reader issue where the toll readers can't read the Cherokee license plates, that should be a non-issue in these mm-hmm. negotiations. His position is that the state knew when they were acquiring this new equipment that there were Cherokee license plates out there, and that they should have that the state of Oklahoma during the procurement process should have bought equipment that allowed them to read all of the license plates that were out there. I mean, because they're not just reading Oklahoma license plates. They're not just reading tribal license plates. They're reading license plates from around the country. I think that, you know, that is a very valid point from Chief Hoskin in saying, listen, just because you guys left us out doesn't mean that you now get to penalize us in this negotiation process.
Orion and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. Programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny Mae Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.
Step into the world of limitless imagination with Beyond the Art podcast, where Indigenous creativity knows no bounds. Join me, Corey Beaumont Flynn, host of Beyond the Art, on a captivating journey through art and innovation, where we delve into the depths of imagination, daring to push the boundaries of what's possible. Our guests, hailing from the Native American art world, represent diverse artistic sectors, from musicians to photographers, beadwork artists to filmmakers, each sharing their unique creative vision and inspiring journeys. Search for Beyond the Art and start listening today.